Hey, Scott Spears back with you here for hour number two of the big program today, and what a great program we've had so far. We want to thank the Yoda of memory, as coined by Time Magazine, Harry Lorraine, for being on with us in hour number one. What a stimulating hour that was to learn about memory, magic, and great people in television like Jack Parr and Ed Sullivan and Johnny Carson. And Harry will definitely be back with us in the future. What a great hour that was with Harry Lorraine. A little bit of housekeeping here. Coming up on Wednesday, 1:10 until 2 p.m., we're going to be joined by the head of the Ohio Democratic Party, David Pepper. David has not been with us since before November's election last year, and he'll be back with us for the entire hour this coming Wednesday, 1:15 to 2 p.m., to discuss the elections last year, which did not go very well statewide for Democrats, and what he thinks of the contenders in the Democratic primary for president and all kinds of things going on here in Ohio. So, David Pepper coming up on Wednesday. But this is an hour that I've wanted to do for a long time because one of the greatest comedians, if not the greatest comedians, and certainly stars of the early days of radio, late days of radio, early days of television, was the great Jack Benny. And we know Jack Benny so well. We've seen him in so many different areas, talk shows, television shows, radio shows. We know all about his wife, Mary Livingston. And sadly, they're both gone, but they did have a child. The child's name is Joan. And to recount the life of the great Jack Benny and also her mother, Mary Livingston. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones Joan Benny. Joan, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Scott.
Joan, it's so great to talk with you. I, last night, went on one of the internet channels and pulled up some of your father's old shows, and they hold up so well.
I think the radio shows, for me at least, the radio shows hold up better than the television shows.
Your father was really the king of radio. What do you think it was about him and that medium that worked so well?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with a long, long training ground, which is something that doesn't happen today. But way back, a lot of people don't even remember what vaudeville was, but my father was in vaudeville for 20 years, and that was a long time to learn your craft. And you went from town to town. You told a joke. If it worked, you told it again in the next town. If it didn't work, you let it drop. And you had so many years to practice. So by the time he got into radio, he was very accomplished, and he knew what was funny. As a matter of fact, I'm frequently asked, was he funny at home? And the answer is no, he wasn't really. But one of his writers said to me, and it's so true, your father had a great sense of humor. He knew what was funny, and he'd had all those years to learn that.
Mm. You know, it's very interesting because I've seen recently with the replays of the Dick Cavett shows and the Johnny Carson shows, later on in his life, he did many talk show appearances, but there's still that Jack Benny personality that developed on radio and television over the years. How close was that Jack Benny to your father?
That was him, or he, if pardon my English grammar, that was he. What you saw was what you got. He was a very sweet, gentle man, and I think that came through in his appearances. And what you saw, is he was what you saw.
Did he worry about his career? Did he worry about doing the best he could? Was he a perfectionist?
Yes, he was. I don't think he worried about his career, but he certainly worried about his next show.
Mm. What kind of father was he growing up?
Well, I couldn't imagine anybody better. He was very caring. He was a lovely father in spite of, you have to take into consideration, the fact that he was very involved with his career. He was very involved with the next radio show or the next television show. But interestingly enough, he included me. He would tell me what he was doing on the next show, tell me who was going to be on the show, some of the routines, and he made me a part of it, which was so dear.
The radio and television shows that we remember so well, how involved was he in those programs?
That is something, actually, I can't answer, because when he went into television, I had just started college, and like any 18-year-old, I was totally involved with myself. I was involved with school and with my friends and what I was doing, and I was away from home. And so I wasn't home during those early days of television. So I'm almost blank on that.
Did he like the mediums of radio and television, or did he prefer the stage better?
Oh, I think he loved radio, and he loved the stage. He got used to television because that's what he had to do, and I think he learned to enjoy it, but radio was his medium.
There was certainly no bigger star in those days than Jack Benny. What was it like to go out in public with him?
It was wonderful. It was glamorous. People stopped him for his autograph. He was recognized everywhere, and I kind of basked in that glory.
Mm. It's very interesting because your mother, Mary Livingston, is so well-remembered as well for her appearances with your father. What kind of mother was she?
Well, that's a different story. My mother was very difficult, and, you know, I wrote a book, and there's a chapter about her, and I explained my relationship with her, which was never easy. She was very, I guess the best way to put it is, she was very unsure of herself, and she was very nervous about any performance, and I think she compared herself to Gracie Allen, because my father's best friend was George Burns, and they, Gracie and George, and my parents were together a lot. And I think my mother always felt that she couldn't compare, because Gracie had been on the stage since she was a child. So Gracie was to the manor born, so to speak, and my mother was an upstart. And she felt that she was never as good, which was very sad, because I think my mother was fabulous on radio. She was the audience loved her, and her timing was terrific, and she was wonderful, and I don't think she ever felt that.
Mm-hmm. I remember when she left doing shows with your father, that so many people wanted her to come back and do them, and I think occasionally she did it. But what was her reason for staying away in those years?
She was a nervous wreck. Simple as that.
Mm. What was her relationship with your father, offset?
Hard to say. As the daughter, one never is sure of your parents' relationship, but as far as I could tell, it was very loving. My father adored her and did everything for her, cared about her a great deal, and pretty much catered to her wishes. And so it all worked just fine.
Your father, of course, involved his real-life wife in his programs, in his career. You were involved as well. Why was that important to him? Did he ever say?
Did he ever say what?
Why was it important to involve his real-life family in what he was doing?
Oh, my goodness, I don't think I can answer that.
How did it come about that you would be part of his career?
I don't remember. I think it was pretty much accidental. They needed somebody to play a part, and I read the script, and I said, Daddy, can I do that? Or something like that. Honestly, Scott, I don't remember.
What was it like to work with him?
It was such fun. I felt like I was a little bit of a celebrity, too, which I knew I wasn't, but as I said, it was glamorous. I had a very glamorous childhood.
There were a lot of interesting things, and I was thinking last night about Jack Benny as I was watching these programs, that there are so many people and things, like your mother, which are so closely associated with him, and I just wanted to run down some of these things that maybe you saw interactions or get the real story behind them. And of course, the one that comes to mind, aside from your mother, is the feud with Fred Allen. How did that come about, and what was that all about?
That was about ratings. I think they cooked it up together. I don't remember exactly because, of course, I was very young then. My having read about it, I know more from what I read than what I know. And I believe that the two of them cooked it up together. They were very good friends. Of course, Fred lived in New York, and my father lived in Beverly Hills. But they were close, and I think at some point on his show, Fred made a disparaging remark, a very funny remark about my father, and my father's writers wrote something in return, and they probably discussed it and thought, what a good idea, let's keep this going. It was great for ratings for both shows.
How long, I was trying to think the other night, how long did that go on that people thought that they didn't like each other?
I don't know. That I have no memory, whether it was a year, I don't know.
Of course, one of the other great characters in your father's show and in your father's life was that of Rodchester. Tell me about that, the man behind that character.
Well, here we go again. That's hard to say. My father, like most men and women, had three types of friends. There were the couple friends, the couples my parents went out to dinner with and were friendly with. And there were the buddy friends, the men my father played golf with, or went, well, he didn't bowl, but the guys together. And that was a different category of friends. And then, like most men, there were the business friends, the people you saw at the office. And the cast of the Jack Benny Show, they were business friends. They were people that they saw every Saturday for rehearsal and Sunday for the show, but they really had no personal relationship. And I knew Rodchester because I saw him every Sunday because I went to the shows, the radio shows on Sundays, and I saw him every Sunday, and he was always very sweet to me, but I knew nothing of his personal life. I know that he gambled. I know he loved the horses, and he had, as you probably know, a career outside of the Jack Benny Show. He was a wonderful actor, dancer, singer, and he was in a couple of wonderful movies. Are you familiar with Cabin in the Sky?
Absolutely.
I mean, he was fabulous in that. So he had a life outside of the Jack Benny Show.
When you would go to watch a radio show taped in those days, what was it like? What, you know, people obviously could not see what was going on at home, but what was the atmosphere like when a show like that was taped?
Well, I think it was the same atmosphere at any stage performance or radio performance. As I said, I went on Sundays, and there was on the side of the stage, there was two booths that overlooked the stage. One was for the engineers, and the other was for people watching the show, and I was one of those. I don't remember what they called it now, the guest booth or something like that, but that's where I sat every Sunday and watched the show. And that was great fun. I loved Sundays. I loved going to the studio and being greeted by all the members of the cast and people and watching the show, and like I said, feeling like the star's daughter. It was wonderful.
Was he ever nervous? Was Jack Benny ever nervous before these performances?
Not that it showed, but yes, he was very nervous, and the only reason I know that is he bit his nails down to the quick. But you would never have known that he was nervous except for that one thing.
There are two things that are so closely associated with Jack Benny, and even when you bring his name up today, these two things come up, and I want to run these two down. And obviously, probably the most famous thing associated with he is the violin. How did that start, and what was his relationship with the violin?
Okay, his mother wanted him to be a concert violinist from the time he was born. And when he was very young, they gave him a miniature violin, and he had violin lessons, and he studied the violin all through his young life. There was one little problem. He really didn't like to practice. They lived in a house overlooking Lake Michigan in Waukegan, Illinois, and he would stare out at the lake and dream of foreign places, and he was a daydreamer, and so he didn't really practice much, but he was good enough that when he was a teenager and dropped out of high school, he was hired by the orchestra in the local vaudeville theater. And he played in the pit, in the orchestra pit at that theater. And he did that for quite a long time. And he wanted to leave home and go on the road and play the violin. Excuse me. But his parents wouldn't let him leave home. Actually, what happened? The Marx Brothers came to town, to Waukegan. And my father met their mother, Minnie. And Minnie asked my dad if he would go on the road with them as their conductor and musical director. And my father wanted to do it, but his parents wouldn't let him leave home. They said, you can't leave home until you're 18. And when he was 18, that's what he did. And he left home, and he went into vaudeville with a middle-aged woman who played piano. My father played the violin, and this lady played the piano. Her name was Cora Salisbury, and they played vaudeville theaters fairly close to home. They didn't stray too far, and they had this little act, and then came World War One. Dad joined the Navy, and he was stationed at the Great Lakes Naval Training Center, which was not far from Waukegan, and he played in the orchestra there, and at some point, they put on a show. And it was kind of the Navy version of the Irving Berlin Army show, Yip, Yip, You Hang. Anyway, they put on this show, and there was a gentleman who was playing, who was an actor in these shows, and you probably remember his name was Pat O'Brien. And Pat O'Brien asked my dad if he would take part in one of the skits in the show, and he did. And he told jokes, and the audience laughed. And he said, gee, I like this. And when he went back into vaudeville, he went back with another partner, and he still played the violin, but he started telling jokes in between the violin numbers. And one thing led to another, told more jokes, played less violin, and eventually by the time he got into radio, he had stopped playing the violin completely. And it wasn't for some years that he decided he wanted to go back to it. So he hired a teacher, and he started studying the violin again and fell in love with it. That's all he wanted to do was play the violin. He would have given up comedy in a New York second or New York minute if he could have been a concert violinist. Mm. And that was his interest in the violin. And then in later years, I guess you know, he started doing concerts all over the country with leading orchestras to raise money for the musicians' pension fund. And, of course, they were comedy concerts. And next question you're going to ask me is, how well did he play? And I will quote Isaac Stern, who's a very close friend, and my father would have traded places in a minute with him. Isaac said to me one day, when your father comes out on the stage in his white tie and tails, he is so elegant and so suave, it's a shame he has to play.
That answers it. That answers it without question. That's a great story. Joan, the other thing that follows your father everywhere, close second to the violin, was he cheap?
Was he cheap?
Yeah, tight with money. That was
Just the opposite. Because of his reputation, he felt like he had to overtip and overspend just so people wouldn't think he was really cheap in person. And he wasn't. He was very generous.
One thing that every comedian, and there are so many of them, who followed or wanted to follow in Jack Benny's footsteps, always talks about is his timing. Did he understand that, or was that just something he naturally did?
Well, again, like back in vaudeville, it's something he perfected over the years. But he was asked about it on many occasions, and his answer was, yes, I do have good timing, but it's timing for me. It's my timing. My timing wouldn't work for Bob Hope.
Mm. It's very true.
And he was right. He had perfect timing for his call.
Absolutely. After the radio show, after the television show, when he decided to stop doing those, what was his life like then? Did he like not having a place to go every day?
Well, he almost every day. He played golf, and he was still performing. He did a lot of concerts around the country. He played theaters. He did a stage show, and he was always busy.
Why did he stop doing the television show?
You'd have to tell me that. I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure. When he went out the years after television, because obviously the popularity of television, the popularity of radio, he was certainly number one. When he would go out and play crowds in later years, what was the reaction like from the crowds?
Oh, it was the same. It never diminished. It was wonderful. I mean, he played Las Vegas quite often. And the crowds were fantastic. They just loved him.
Want to talk about some people he worked with certainly many times over the years, and just kind of talk about what their relationship was and what you remember of these legendary people. And we'll start, of course, with George Burns.
Well, it's very hard for me to talk about George Burns because my memories of my childhood very much center around George Burns, because he was hilariously funny, and my father and George had a legendary relationship. They were joined at the hip. They adored each other, and George, who you may know, his real name was Nathan Birnbaum, and so he was known as Nat or Natty, and for me, he was Uncle Natty. Anyway, Natty could always make my father laugh, and my father could never make him laugh. And the two of them together were so hysterically funny, I can't describe it. And you had to have been there because you knew that something funny was going to happen. You were anticipating something that George would do to my father. He would, when they both lived in Beverly Hills, and my father loved to walk. And he'd be walking wherever to visit friends. And Natty would drive by and stop the car that hijacked. And my father would cross the street to say hello to Natty, and Natty would drive away. That was the kind of humor that went on between them. And I remember my childhood filled with laughter because of those two men.
What about Bob Hope?
Bob Hope was not as close a personal friend, but they loved each other. And I didn't see Bob as often, but he was always very, very nice to me and very helpful. If I needed a favor or if I needed to interview him about something I was writing or doing, he was always available, and he was a dear, sweet man.
Lucille Ball.
Well, she lived next door, and I really didn't know her, but she and her, at that time, husband Desi, moved into the house next door when I was probably starting high school. And so I went to boarding school. No longer home a lot, so I never knew her. But my father used to go over to their house next door all the time. And there's a lot of very funny stories told about my father going over to Lucy's. And they were very good friends.
And finally, Johnny Carson.
Well, Johnny adored my dad, and as you know, he took a lot of his timing and father, and my dad loved him. Just loved Johnny.
I think I read somewhere where Johnny, who was not known as being an emotional man, one of his wives said one of the few times that he ever saw Johnny cry is when they heard that your father had passed away.
Oh, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's true. Johnny loved my father.
There's an interesting thing with your father when it came to the end of his life, and I don't know if most people know this. Everybody has seen the Sunshine Boys, George Burns and Walter Matthau. Now, your father was slated to play the role that George Burns played and won the Academy Award for. Is that correct?
That is true.
What happened? I mean, I know he became ill, but what was the process there? He had accepted the role, and what happened?
Well, my father's agent was a man named Irving Sein, and when my father died, obviously he couldn't play the role, and Irving, who knew George very well, got the role for George and became George's agent. Let's put it this way, Irving lost no time.
It doesn't sound like it. When did your father realize he was ill?
Not really until the very end. I think, I'm laughing because I remember my dad was a hypochondriac, and he was always imagining things wrong with him. And I remember before he died, as you probably know, he had pancreatic cancer. He did not know that, but he was having severe tummy pains, and he would complain. But typically, my mother and or I would say, you know, stop complaining. It's your imagination. Go out and play golf. And he believed that because he knew he was a hypochondriac. So it wasn't really until pancreatic cancer can go very quickly, and fortunately, my father didn't last long, which was good because towards the end, of course, he was reasonably sedated and on pain medication. So he, in some ways, he really didn't know what hit him.
Jack Benny passed away on December 26, 1974. He was 80 years old. What are the last memories of your father? What were the last conversation you had with him like?
Well, I have sitting in front of me as we speak a lovely photograph of the two of us that was taken in the garden at his house, and it was the last photograph he ever took, and he looked wonderful. You would never know that he was ill at all, and that's one of my memories. And then, again, I was away. By this time, I was married and had four children, and so I was very involved in my own life and my children, and I really didn't know until close to the end. And when I finally did know that it was really just a matter of a few days, then I was at the house the whole time and spent all the time with him.
When he did go on December 26th, it was, of course, national news. What is it like to be at the center of that? Your father has passed away, you're grieving your father, but there's media attention, every celebrity is paying homage to him. What was that experience like?
It's kind of blanked out. I don't remember. I remember all the people coming to the house for the day before he died. He was in a coma. This was the day after Christmas. And he was in a coma, and people started coming to the house in droves. There must have been 50 or 60 people in my parents' living room. And he was upstairs asleep or in a coma. And I remember it being almost a celebratory day because the whole day, people in that room were telling stories of their memories of funny things that had happened and all the events that they remember being with my dad. And it was a day of a lot of laughter.
Mm.
As I said, it was kind of celebrating his life.
When you saw the Sunshine Boys, knowing that that role had supposed to have been his, what was it like to watch that movie? Also knowing George Burns so well.
Well, I thought Natty was so good in that movie that I don't think I thought much about it, other than I was glad that Natty had gotten the part, because it was just so right for him. I'm not sure that it wasn't a better role for him than it would have been for my dad.
When he won the Academy Award, what did George think about that? Did you ever talk to him about it?
No, I never did. I have no idea.
You talked.
I didn't see that much of George after my father died. I'd see him once in a while. I was very close to his daughter, Sandra, and I grew up together. But I don't think I saw a lot of Natty after my dad died.
You talked about your father's manager, Irving Fine, who became George Burns' manager, became a legendary figure in his own right. What are your memories of Irving?
Well, mostly they're funny, because Irving was an agent from the tip of his toes to the top of his head. And my funny memory of him was the day after my father died, I was sitting at their house, and Irving had gone to the mortuary to make arrangements. And I was sitting there, the front door opened, and there was Irving. And I said, "Hi, Irving, how did it go?" And Irving said, "I made a great deal on the coffin." I fell apart. I mean, is that the perfect agent story of all time?
That's a great story. That's the best. Joan, when you look back at your father's work, obviously you said you preferred his radio work. Do you have a favorite episode of something he did on radio?
Not so much on, well, I think The Vault was my favorite recurring bit, was when he went to the vault to get his money.
We talked about your mother and you having a little bit of a difficult relationship with her. When your father died, what were your mother's remaining years like?
I would say very sad. My mother, as I said, she was a difficult woman, and she never felt that she measured up. And I think that her whole being was being Mrs. Jack Benny. And when my father was no longer around, I think it was a very sad time for her. Hard for me to say. She wasn't particularly well-liked. Read George Burns's book, or books. And I think after he died, she was no longer invited to the parties that she had been because of my father. And I think her remaining years were very sad.
You know, Joan, you've written about this, and so many people listening to this who remember Mary Livingston so well, it probably blows their mind, if they haven't heard this before, that she was difficult, not well-liked, terms that have been used here. Was there ever a moment before she passed away that you were able to mend fences with her?
Not really. I mean, I saw her a lot. I would spend time at her house visiting. Visiting my mother was a little bit like paying court. She was the queen bee. And even with my children, when they saw her, went over to her house to pay court. So, as I said, she was difficult. It's hard for me to talk about her. I don't, you know, this is not Mommy Dearest.
Right, right. Absolutely. Your father left such a great body of work on television and radio and stage shows and talk shows. Is there a lot of residuals left in those shows? I know they play all the time.
I don't know. You'd have to ask my children, because whatever there is there, I think, was divided among my four children, not to me. And I think they do get some money here and there. Not a lot, but I think every so often they get a check for $3.50.
They always talk about the residuals. It's interesting when people talk about exactly what happens after a number of years. Of his personal belongings, you talked about the picture you have, the last picture that he took. Is there anything you have of his that you kept?
Well, I'd have to think about that, Scott. I think there must be. But I offhand, I can't think what.
Where did his violins and things like that go?
Well, his Stradivarius is with the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. And it was to be played by their concertmaster. However, their current concertmaster has his own Guarnarius or Stradivarius, I'm not sure. And as of now, the last I heard, the assistant concertmaster plays it. But they're very proud of that violin, and I'm very pleased it went to the orchestra.
How has being the daughter of Jack Benny, when people find this out, changed from the 70s till today? People still know who he is, but how has...
No, they don't.
They don't.
No.
They don't.
Mm-mm, not unless you're over 70 or 80.
When did you start to notice that happening, that he was being forgotten a little bit?
Well, it happens very gradually. I spent quite a few years, like 20, lecturing. I went all over the country doing lectures about... Somebody asked me to do it, and I reluctantly agreed, and it became a kind of career. And I did a whole lecture series about growing up in Hollywood. And as I kept doing it, my audience kept getting smaller and smaller. And I'm thinking, you know, as I used to say, my audience was between 70 and dead. Well, now my audience is dead. There are very few people around who remember. But time goes on. I mean, there's... No.
Yeah, yeah.
People under 70 have never heard of him. But people under 70 have never heard of Cary Grant.
That's true. That's true. Time does go on. When historians go back and look at radio, which they do, and television, certainly in its early days, where is your father's place? Where do you believe he belongs, objectively?
Well, in the days of radio, I would say he belongs right at the top, certainly in the top 5 or 10, at least. When it comes to television, it goes way down. I mean, you start out with the biggest star in television in the early days was Milton Berle. And, you know, my father did very well in television, but not to the extent that he had in radio.
What's something about your father you could tell us that the people who do remember him wouldn't have ever known?
What a difficult question that is. I think probably what a truly nice man he was. What a generous... He was, and he was known for this in the business, as being the nicest man in the business. And, okay, here's what I would say about him. He never finished his first year of high school, but he had an innate intelligence about people and about the world and about his place. And he once said, this came up, I won't bore you with a long story, but it had to do with billing in Las Vegas, the marquee outside the hotel, which in your contract, if you're the star, you get 100% billing, which means you get the biggest letters. And then the opening act gets 75% or 50%. Their letters are smaller. And there was an opening act with him one time, and the contract, this person's contract, it was Abby Lane, actually, and her contract said that she got 100% billing. And when she saw the marquee, her letters were smaller. And my father complained and said, wait a minute, I want her letters to be the same size as mine. And she said, what a wonderful thing to do. And my dad said, and this is the answer to your question about what people might not know about him. My father said, the size of your letters doesn't matter. The audience knows who the star is. You don't have to tell them by the size of your letters.
Mm. Very interesting.
He always trusted his audience, and he was very generous with other actors and performers on the show. He wanted them to star. He wanted them to have all the good lines. He wanted them to shine because he felt that it never took away from him. He encouraged other comedians because he felt that the more comedians there were, the better it was for comedy.
Joan,
that's so intelligent.
It really is. We have about 3 minutes left here, and of course a man who brought people so much laughter. Is there a favorite story you have, a funny story of your father, maybe with George Burns or somebody else?
Well, only the ones I've told you about. I mean, I could do George Burns stories forever and ever. I once did, okay, I was in Washington, D.C. I was doing one of my lectures, and my time was about up. This was a symposium. There were a lot of lecturers, one after another, and I was given 20 minutes. And at the end of the 20 minutes, I was now doing Q&A, and a man at the back of the auditorium raised his hand, and I said, yes, I have time for one more question. And he said, tell us about your father and George Burns. And I said, well, I only have 20 seconds left, and I can't do it in 20 seconds. But I said, if you'll go out in the hallway, I'll meet you out in the hallway, and I'll be happy to tell you as many stories as you would like to hear. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I put my microphone down, and I left the stage and went out in the hall. The problem was that everybody in the audience followed out into the hall. And what I had completely forgotten, because I was on a roll, I had forgotten that there was another speaker right after me, and there was nobody left in the audience. They all went out in the hall to hear my stories about George Burns.
So that would have been his closest friend without doubt, George Burns.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What do you think it was about the two that worked so well?
Well, my father loved to laugh. He loved people who were funny. And he thought George Burns was the funniest man he knew. And I have to agree.
Yeah, without doubt. Why do you think, I mean, Bob Hope, 100, George Burns, 100, why do you think comedians live long lives?
Well, I don't think they do. I think it's just hit or miss. Those two did. On the other hand, you can name a lot of comedians who died very young.
Well, that's an interesting. That we'll wrap up on this question, Joan, because it's interesting. Nobody in their day was a bigger star than your father when there really weren't things like stars in mass media, television, radio, so on and so forth. And we do hear about so many comedians who are tormented, who have bad endings. Was there any trauma in your father's life?
I don't think so, and I think that's one of the things that made him unique, because, as you pointed out, so many comedians are tortured souls, and for some reason, my father was not a tortured soul, and he was funny without being a tortured soul.
He certainly was funny. There's no doubt about that. I watching those shows yesterday, something that dawned on me at one point, if you just, you know, colorize these things and people didn't know, they're so well written, they're so well put together that, and he's so funny. It's really, he was a class act without question, I think. When you think of your father today, what do you think of?
Well, I think of how wonderful he was and how much I loved him and what an incredible life I've had thanks to him.
Joan, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show, remembering your father, and people who maybe don't remember him will go find him tonight.
I hope so.
Yeah, and watch or listen to him, because it's certainly worth it. The legendary Jack Benny. The guest has been Joan Benny, his daughter. Joan, thank you so much, and you have a great day.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Joan Benny, how about that? Remembering her father? The legendary Jack Benny. How about the stories about Mary Livingston? I had not heard that before. Had you? We're done for today, but we've got much more coming up here on WWGH Radio, Voice of a People with Linda Sims at 4:10, and the Mike Wilson Show at 5:10, and much more right after this. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
On FM is supported by CRT Mechanicals. Address 2842 Marion Waldo Road. Telephone number 740-5495. Webpage CRT.